Good evening. I'm Nicholas Sirota, and it's my pleasure. I'm director of the Tate, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here this evening. If there's one partner that we enjoy working with, it is the Architecture Foundation, and we've done so at Tate Modern and on Tate Britain in the past. And as you know, this series of two events is organized in collaboration with the Architecture Foundation. In developing our ideas for the Francis Bacon exhibition, in discussion in particular with Brian Clark, representing the estate, we became conscious of the fact that Bacon is always seen in isolation. He's separated from his peers. He tends to be separated from ideas about other painting and indeed architecture, design, the urban fabric. And we conceived the idea with Brian that it would be interesting to try and set Bacon in a context and to use Bacon's work as a way of exploring certain ideas about what was happening in London in particular, but Britain more widely, during the period in which Bacon was working. So, working with the Architecture Foundation, with Rowan Moore, and with Justin Jekyll, we bring you this series. I particularly want to thank Brian Clark, artist, chairman of the Architecture Foundation, as I've already mentioned, engaged with the Bacon legacy in every sense, for his encouragement of this event. And I'd now like to invite Brian to say a few words to introduce the evening. Brian.
Thank you. Thanks, Nick. The Architecture Foundation has as its chairman in me an artist, and you might well ask why. It's a question I frequently ask, and I can't give you a reasonable answer to it, really. But when the Bacon exhibition came about at the Tate, and we were in discussion, as Nick described earlier, it seemed a great opportunity to bring the Architecture Foundation and the Bacon Estate together to try, with Tate, to produce a series of debates, discussions, and lectures that might try and bridge this divide between art and architecture as much as we could. And it's the Architecture Foundation wish and optimistic hope that we'll be able to further bridge that gulf in the next few years with a developing program that I think you'll find interesting. Tonight we've got a discussion on the changes to the built environment and the challenges to modernity that have paralleled Francis Bacon's work and lifetime and continue to do so today. And on the 22nd of October, the second in this series, Texture, tonight is Texture, and the second in the series will be, the title is Back to the City with Ken Livingstone, Nigel Coates, and Joseph Rickvert. I think I'm right in saying that that event is sold out, but you could ask if there are tickets available should you want them. I'd like to thank very much Joe Kerr tonight from the Royal College of Art for agreeing to chair this event, and to remind you too, if I may, that the Architecture Foundation, in association with Tate, will be hosting a number of these kinds of events, and if you watch our website, you'll be kept aware of them. There are also a series of extremely good lectures organized by Tate around the Francis Bacon issue generally and around his work, and I wholeheartedly recommend that you look at those. It looks like a very exciting series of events coming up. So anyway, thank you very much. Thank you, Joe. And thank you very much, of course, to the panel members who have taken part tonight. So I'll let you get on with it. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's fantastic to see such a full house for the first of these two discussions. It's been a great pleasure for me in the past to have done events both for Tate Britain and for the Architecture Foundation. This is the first time I've done one for them both together, although they have collaborated in the past and will do so again in the future. It's a very, very interesting kind of area we're trying to work in this evening. We're looking at, you know, the excuse is the centenary exhibition for Francis Bacon, but the panel consists entirely of architects and teachers of architecture. And it'll be interesting to see what connections, if any, we can tease out between art and architecture. Also, I think the first of these two talks, which is about texture, is kind of naturally situated in the post-war period, in British culture of the 1950s and early 1960s, which makes it slightly strange to be sitting here in this kind of tangerine orange space, which is clearly of a different era. and of course, one of the questions that's implicit in this is about the relationship between modernism and what came after postmodernism. So I suppose in that sense, it's interesting that we're sitting in a space that's quite firmly POMO. Now, the way tonight's going to work is that shortly there'll be a keynote address, and then there'll be a discussion between the panel, and then we hope to have plenty of time to throw it open to you, the audience, to ask questions and to question what the speakers have said. I have to say that very rarely have I ever chaired such a kind of stellar panel, particularly in my own discipline of architecture, and I'll introduce them in a second. But just to think again about being in Britain, and perhaps especially in London, in the late 1950s. Because, of course, one of the excuses for talking about texture is that people have perceived some kind of relationship, at least a visual relationship, a formal relationship, between the heavy textured technique, the painting of Bacon, and the kind of heaviness that infected and informed British architecture of the period. That may be a spurious link. I hope at least one of my panelists will disagree with that proposition. But we're in an era also, we're talking about both an artist, and here we're talking with architects who are coming out of what we might generally call modernism. And it's very interesting to think that when you go and look at the Bacon Show, the work there, it's not ageless. We can kind of define its age, but somehow painting survives the passage of time in a very, very different way than architecture does. You know, painting does not have to go through the same kind of change of requirements and demands that are made of buildings, nor, of course, does it actually go through the kind of heavy usage that tends to make buildings decay and need to change. I mean, it's very interesting that one of our panelists, Patrick Hodgkinson, whose most famous scheme, the Brunswick Centre, was built over a long period of time when Bacon was kind of at the peak of his career. And that scheme has already itself now had to be refurbished, luckily, by the same architect. But of course, painting never goes through that kind of transformation. So one of the questions I would like to consider in this discussion is, you know, over time, how do we look back on painting and on architecture as very, very different animals? Just to introduce the panel briefly, on my far right, we have Patrick Hodgkinson. I've just realized, of course, that although I come from the Royal College, otherwise this panel is so solidly Architectural Association that it seems like the AA has decamped from Bedford Square to Millbank here, but representing very different generations of the AA as well, which I think is interesting. When I realized how AA it was, I was trying to think of a connection between Bacon and Bedford Square and couldn't make one. So if anyone can, that would help the evening along nicely.
The bar.
Excuse me?
The bar.
The bar, yeah, that's true. Well, perhaps, possibly alcohol is the connection between many of the things we'll talk about tonight. and afterwards, naturally. Patrick Hodgkins.
I don't drink Coke, so I don't have
Patrick trained at the AA in the 1950s before going to work most famously with Alvar Aalto and then with Sir Leslie Martin. And for me as a historian of architecture, he is one of the great figures in formulating a particular idea about architecture in the post-war period, which was that you could build at the necessary densities for urban life without having to build high-rise buildings. And of course, the Brunswick itself is a great exemplar of that. But Patrick has also devoted a great deal of his career to teaching. On my immediate right is Tony Fretton, also very, very AA, founded Tony Fretton Architects in 1982. But apart from that practice, which is most famous, I suppose, for its work with art galleries, with the Listen Gallery, Camden Arts Centre, and others, also as an exhibition designer, but as a teacher and a writer. He's visiting professor at the Belacher Institute and the École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, and at the Harvard Graduate School. On my immediate left is, of course, Zaha Hadid, also very closely associated with the AA, but like most of the panelists, also associated with architecture in Northern Europe, not just in Britain. She worked for Rem Koolhaas and OMA before establishing her own practice in 1980, and I suppose has had an absolutely unique architectural career in that the first portion of her career, she was famous more for the buildings she designed that wasn't built, but then suddenly that somersaulted round, and now she, of course, has reached international fame with buildings all around the world. But also in terms of tonight's discussion, it is interesting to have someone who is well known not only as an architect, but also as a painter. On my far left is Mark Cousins, who is going to shortly give the keynote address. Mark is Director of General Studies and Head of the Graduate Programme in Histories and Theories at the Architectural Association. He's Visiting Professor of Architecture at Columbia and Visiting Professor at the Architecture School at the University of Navarre at Pamplona. He's connected through writing and through research with, I think, all of the panellists, probably at some time or other. So in a sense, you are the kind of thread that links all of us together. And he has written recently on the subject of ugliness, which I think is something that will rear its head fairly soon. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Mark to deliver the keynote. As you wish.
Thank you very much. I agreed that I'd only take a quarter of an hour of your time so that there can be a proper discussion. So you'll stop me when I've reached that point. I can't remember now whether it was in the catalogue to the current exhibition at Bacon or whether it was on one of those panels. But at some point there was a quotation from Bacon saying, I suppose in the end we're just meat. And I wanted to try and start off, as it were, some thoughts about both texture and also materiality by considering some of the problems, what we might call the aesthetic problems of meat, especially in that difficult area that we call ugliness, or which other people call ugliness. I want to try and suggest this evening that it's not how it's normally portrayed, and if properly handled, is an extremely powerful and valuable artistic and architectural instrument. Let me invite you first to engage in a thought experiment. You look at someone's face. As we scan someone's face, we look, as it were, for signs of expression. In some sense, for the way in which the face is thought to be able to represent emotions or states of mind or whatever. As we do it, invariably we have a fantasy that this expression does not simply belong to the surface, but it has a depth. And we frequently actually experience that as a depth. But of course, it has this peculiarity because the depth is not remotely localized. If we say he looked sad, we don't sort of say, you know, it looked about 2 centimeters deep in the sadness of it. Now, nowhere I think, is it more remarkable, that if you add in to this picture of a face, which you experience partly through the dimension of the depth of its expression, and then imagine suddenly, in some process, the face suddenly manifests a wound. And you suddenly see that underneath the infinitesimally thin layer of skin, there's blood and there's flesh and there's bone. Normally, people have a kind of visceral turning away from this experience. Now, if you try to follow through this action of turning away, we might wonder, what is it that we're turning away from? Since I have a small amount of time, let me kind of suggest immediately that the appearance of the wound indicates suddenly the collapse. The collapse of what? I mean, I'm going to say representation, but I don't mean it in a representational way. It's as if I can't continue having a fantasy about the depth of your sadness or the extent of your pleasure. I can't do it any longer because, as it were, it is disrupted by the appearance of a wound. Essentially, unless you're medically knowledgeable, what you're seeing, and I think Bacon was quite correct to use it in a general sense, is what he calls meat. Let's kind of make a formula in some sense of saying what meat is at a kind of the level of experience is almost the collapse of representation or of signification. It may be actually that this is one of the unacknowledged reasons for vegetarianism. Certainly, you know, the American hatred of internal organs of animals to eat seems to belong to this. And it's strange, and I think in the States you can see gradually over the decades the chicken has actually become a vegetable. Salmon is soon following it. This collapse of representation is, I think, part of what we might call the experience of ugliness, the turning away. At which point we might begin to hypothesize that this is not what I think it is, it's what I think people experience it as. The experience of the ugly in that sense is this: it is without signification. It is without being part of a space of representation. It is stuff. It is meat. We might think really of our horror. Let's think really about the difference between a ghost and a zombie. Ghosts, in some sense, we quite like, or rather literature quite likes, because the ghost is the great supporter of narrative. The ghost has something that he or she wants to tell us. The problem is the ghost has no life. It needs our warmth. It needs a bit of our life in order to be able to tell what it has to say, what it must say. By contrast, the zombie, these kind of the undead, they're alive. They're actually murderously alive. And their chosen diet is signification. They eat up signs. They eat up representation. They, in that sense, meatify, carnify the entire world. Now, this would tend to suggest that people's experience of the ugly, again, I'm not saying that's what it is a defense against this moment, a moment which is too raw and is too almost unnerving. We might say that the popular experience of the ugly is it's that which is there, but at the same time is perceived as it shouldn't be there. Or sometimes it's the same, but the other way around. It's that which is not there, but should be. In LaRue's novel, The Phantom of the Opera, there's a wonderful moment when the scene shifter describes to the girls of the Corps de Ballet that he has seen the ghost in box 5. He describes the ghost to the girls, and he says, in a way which logic itself can't tolerate, but clearly we know exactly what he means, he says, and the ghost has no nose, and that no nose is a horrible thing to look at. It's something that isn't there, but should be. I'm not going to continue much longer. But I want to suggest that one dimension of the achievement of Bacon is, in a sense, to take this problem on board directly. And in a way that it's very difficult to describe in his achievement, but has the achievement of, as it were, bringing back meat into our understanding, bringing back meat into a kind of poetics, that which is always, as it were, normally excluded. I was at the exhibition on Sunday, and you look, it's not just a question, as it were, obviously, of meat. It is those strange puddles of existence that you see so clearly in the three triptychs in homage to George Dyer. It is indeed a sublime moment. Now, in a sense, all I've said is an attempt to say that what people describe as being ugly is actually properly considered, we should consider it as a defense. And if you can undo this defense, if, like Bacon, you can propel the spectator into the midst of meat and find it not only human, but essentially human, then, as it were, you remove some of the defenses which so often kind of disable, I don't mind putting it bluntly, disable public taste. It is a struggle. Now, if something like this is the case, and I'm more than aware that I haven't said directly anything about architecture and texture, then one of the ways in which we might consider the issues this evening is to think within the scope of Bacon's adult career, what also happens within architecture to be able to do that at the level of a certain materiality and at the level of texture. That is to say, to undermine the public defense against the ugly and actually to propel it towards something new and powerful and human, not in a humanistic way, but human almost in a somewhat unnerving way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark, and commendably prompt, I must say. One of the things I should have said at the beginning, I guess, is that it was unclear before we began to what extent this panel might themselves engage with Bacon and with painting. This is a panel of architects, after all. But, Mark, you've actually located us firmly with a reference to Bacon himself. And, of course, I wouldn't want to labour the pun about bacon and meat, but you did it very well. I was actually at a conference earlier this year, and a dear friend, a devout Muslim, was put up in a hotel in the Bacon Room, which he found ridiculously unfunny. It was no good pointing out to him that that was the name of a man rather than the backside of a pig. He still thought it was inappropriate. But taking this idea of meat and of ugliness, one of the phrases you used that really caught my attention was this idea of kind of disabling public taste. If we were to think again about brutalism, which is, I suppose, the context for this discussion particularly, the relationship, textural relationship, in the post-war period, would you like to develop that idea of ugliness in architecture disabling public taste?
Well, I think in a way it's maybe the other way around. I mean, it's architects don't like, kind of, for very understandable reasons, they don't want to go on and on about the problems of public taste, because it's very difficult to see quite what you might do about it. That public taste is frequently wrong is an absolute axiom for architects. I think, you know, it's when one kind of thinks about the history of the reception, let's say, actually of something as broad as concrete. I mean, there is what you might call a popular resistance to concrete. And it's very obscure to me why it is. I mean, how come within the clothing industry, you know, denim takes on a kind of ubiquitous but still desirable character?
I don't think so.
Well, there's a lot of it about.
Well, I know, because it's a uniform.
Okay, how about concrete?
You've been challenged here. What about concrete?
What about it? I mean, I'm not an expert on the material.
Well, Mark, can I redirect the question slightly then?
It's an abstract question. What about concrete? You know, what about underwear?
It's not an abstract question, it's a concrete question.
It's not. It's kind of a vague question, you know, as if, you know. I mean, I think that in what context? Infrastructure? Architecture?
Well, I think the word's been introduced specifically because Mark has introduced the idea of ugliness, which seems kind of crucial to this particular debate.
But, you know, I don't relate to the ugliness and concrete in parallel with each other.
Nor do I.
I think rawness is a different story. Rawness and concrete, I think there was a connection, but ugliness, I think taste changes over a period of time. I mean, you know, 15 years ago, people thought, you know, concrete is all this kind of ugly buildings in the South Bank, with water stains, it doesn't last, it's not way. But, you know, we know that that material has advanced, and I don't think people relate to it in the same way. And there's another issue which I think is very important, that people relate to it as a, not a fascist, but a kind of communist material, because it was done in the period when there was kind of a heavy socialist moment. So I think people relate to it in different kind of ways, and not only, maybe some people, you know, think it's ugly, but that's not necessarily. I think rawness, and I think it comes from, I think, a puritanical desire to actually not duplicate decorative material with the structure.
So they're not two issues. And also toughness, you know, that the cities are growing and there's a scale, there's a scale issue, and there's also a structural issue which concrete could achieve, which maybe steel could not. So it came from a very different, and the robustness of the material, and also the how much you can manipulate concrete in a kind of sculptural form, not necessarily painterly. I think that these objects on the roofs of Corbusier's buildings were painterly, in a sense, because they related more to, you know, the Cubist period from painting. I think it translated into these, you know, little cities on the rooftops. But I remember, Patrick, when we were all there, A. Mark was not there.
Right.
So he's kind of, you know, he's only the thread kind of sort of later on. But I remember, I mean, I could be, I'm sure you don't remember that, but I remember this very well, when the Brunswick Center opened, and Patrick was teaching at the A and I was a student. I remember you saying, and I could be wrong, but I have a good memory, these things stick in my mind, that people would not even, they were so kind of incensed by the Brunswick Center that they wouldn't talk to him. You know, I'm not sure they were colleagues or people in the street or friends or students. And I mean, I think that there was already a kind of a change in the scene at the time when I was a student against these projects, not because they were kind of socially related or whatever. There was a reaction to any kind of form. I mean, when I started at the A, we spent 6 months cleaning warehouses, and because I don't know, we were testing noise, and then they wanted to send us to Wales to do urban farming. And then there was another experiment, which is inflatables, so alternative life. So if I would analyze that, it was all about alternative life, and it was all a reaction to what had happened in the city prior to that. But I think that because that was a focus of the agenda of the A at the time, alternative life by default became really the concept of what we were doing. So we had to think of alternatives to the status quo or whatever.
I want to bring in the other side of the panel in a second, but Mark, I just wanted to pursue this point again, that when we look at Bacon and painters like him, you know, they can try as hard as they like to create the shock of the new, to be hard-edged, to be brutal, to kind of alienate public taste. But somehow, in that kind of sphere, the stuff always gets kind of gets subsumed into the canon, doesn't it? You know, that stuff always becomes liked and popular, as Bacon is like no one else today. But the story seems to be slightly different for architecture of the period. Would you agree that it's actually been more difficult for the public to accommodate the kind of hard-edged, heavily textured architecture of the post-war period?
I'm sure there's like a difference, and I think that's kind of important, but somewhat obscure. I mean, I don't think, I mean, for me, it doesn't kind of reward thought to think of Bacon in terms of, like, you know, shocking or the shock of the new or whatever. I mean, I think, you know, the practice is completely kind of rigorous.
It is extreme. I don't think it wasn't done to shock only. It was extreme. It's an extreme condition. Representation of extreme conditions. I think maybe one can say that the brutalist period also represented, and maybe post that.
Well, you know, if we're to view it as extreme, I mean, that's maybe. But as it were, you know, the extremity is dictated by, as it were, being able to bring a kind of non-humanist conception of the human being, of the body, back into a kind of zone of painting, when, after all, so much of the history of painting, you know, takes the human body more in the direction kind of a sort of figural image, I mean, an image. So I don't think it's, you know, the extremity, if it's there, is kind of necessary. And in a way, I think that the same would be true of architecture.
Let me turn the other way. Patrick, you were a student and then a young practitioner in the 1950s and into the early 1960s, the period when Bacon was building his career. And in the period in which his architecture, which became labelled as brutalism or the new brutalism, appeared. Not a term I suspect you agree with necessarily. But would you be conscious of links between the two practices at this time? I mean, do you see a kind of feasible relationship between art and architecture in this period?
Not really. But actually, I'm a bit of a cheat in this respect, because I happened to leave school 2 years early for various reasons. I had an idea I wanted to be a painter myself, and I was painting one day out in the fields near my home in Norfolk, and this old man came up to me and looked at my work and made nice remarks about it and said, why don't you come and work for me in my studio? And I didn't know who the hell he was, but he turned out to be a rather well-known impressionist, English impressionist painter, whose work I knew because it was in the local art gallery in Norwich. And I worked for him for almost a year, which was fascinating because it showed me how to do all the sort of boring bits, if you like, of painting, how to mix pigments and this sort of thing at a young age. And I was able to sort of carry it with me. But when it came to the work he produced, he was an impressionist, but I liked it tremendously because he mostly painted landscapes with animals, horses and cows and that sort of thing. And they gave me the impression of being the sort of horses you imagined yourself, or cows, or whatever it was. And it was no more complicated than that. And although I moved into architecture from there, for various reasons I won't go into, I kept a lot of those impressionist ideas somehow in my head. And I suppose in that respect, I was fairly questioning about cubism and the modern movement in architecture, which I subscribed to. But I was questioning about it. I didn't think it was all marvelous. And actually, as I've grown older, I look back to this chap, Arnsby Brown, and think of his work, and think it's even better than I thought it was when I was a young man. So that going back to your question, I have a mixed idea in my head about painting and architecture, and how well they're related. I don't happen to have thought that Bacon had any notion of, I mean, I didn't have any notion of his painting meaning anything to me as an architect, because it was mainly about hold off of things that architecture simply isn't. It's not about people's inner workings or anything like that. It's about something different. and therefore I'd never made the connection, but I sure found his work interesting over the years, and what I've seen of it. I think actually I myself have to look at his work very carefully to see whether or not it applies to aspects of architecture. Just a moment more, what I find difficult myself, and here I'm being a bit nasty, is that while I've always called myself or thought of myself as modern, I have questioned the idea of modern architecture very strongly, because I think it was a bit mad to start with and got a little madder. And if we talk about things like New Brutalism or a number of words like that, I don't actually think they are architecture. They're what people talk about, but they're about the look of a building and not the feel of it. And I don't care what the building looks like, in a sense, but I do care what it feels like. And that's what I think most people, most of us, actually think about a new building when we walk into it and have a look at it and that sort of thing, what it really feels like.
Thank you. But, I mean, as someone who was practicing in this period, your architecture, of course, at its centre was humanist. Its centre was humanist at its centre. It was about human life and particularly urban life. And yet, its surfaces, its textures were hard, have been characterised as being alienating. People have used words such as raw, as Zaha did, brutal, and ugly, downright ugly. How do you feel like that about your own work? You know, does that make any sense of how you see your own work?
Yes, sure. This business of ugliness, for instance, just because the word's been mentioned, and beauty, I don't think you can talk about them in the way that many people now do talk about them. Because, after all, beauty, we were told when we were in the nursery, practically, was in the eye of the beholder. And I think exactly the same of ugliness. What I don't want to happen is what is happening, which is we should all believe the same thing, be told to believe the same thing. Whereas if you think something's beautiful and I think it's ugly, let's stay that way. That's fine. It's not one thing for everybody, quite definitely. But again, it goes back to what I was referring to just now, which is that it's part of something which I feel is a little remote from what architecture really should be. And it's that remoteness that I now call book modern, because it is out of a book that doesn't exist but is written, kind of thing, which leads us to understand architecture, and particularly today's architecture, in a particular way, which I think needs questioning quite seriously.
You were at the AA at a time when you were taught by those architects who have been called, and we get back to the theme of meat, have been called carnivores, you know, the rough, brutal architects of the 1950s, and yet your work is informed by something very, very different. How do you perceive that legacy?
Well, I wasn't taught by that generation. I was taught principally by James Gowan, who was a completely different type of architect. And the what I would bring from his teaching to this discussion is that his underlying motivation was a sort of existential inquiry. And if we're looking to examine whether there is a relation between Bacon and architecture in general. I think you couldn't say that it, I think you couldn't look at Bacon's effrontery in the best sense of the word, which is, you know, let's say Bacon's inquiry was also existential. But Bacon, Bacon's method, which was legitimate in painting and perhaps in literature, not many other spheres, perhaps graphic art, was could explore areas that architecture can't, in a way that architecture couldn't explore through the extreme graphicness of his imagery and the areas that Marx mentioned. But I think where you could see a connection is that Bacon's inquiry was about existence, and if you remember, he was very taken by Greek tragedy, which has a completely different moral basis from the moral basis that invades Western societies, which is a neither good nor bad attitude, which I particularly find very interesting, rather unmanageable, but interesting. But if we want to make a comparison between Bacon's work and architects, I think you'd have to look at architects like Leverenz or perhaps Borromini, who, in doing projects which were serving an explicit and, let's say, conventional need, which is largely what architects do, were able at certain moments to, for some people looking at the building, to make them consider their fragility as a human being and the perplexing quality of existence. And so if there is a connection, it would be there, but not in the formal levels that are proposed in these questions.
But more specifically in your own work, how do you perceive the legacy of the architecture of this period, the architecture of New Brutalism? Has it informed your work? Is it something that interests you? Or?
Well, you can't, I mean, it's very difficult to influences in architecture, or what you, not influences, what you draw from other periods of architecture or work of other architects who are contemporary with you, is very difficult to describe, and that's as it should be. I mean, if you're doing your work properly as a creative worker, you're transforming that work into something which has other meanings. So certainly that architecture, or the architecture of that period, was what I grew up with, and when I first started to look at architecture, it was what I thought architecture should be. And I admired it, and I still love those buildings. Not, I think, in the UK so much as in continental Europe, where I think it was done with more esprit. So they are things that I liked, but I don't have feelings for them, of direct linkages into the work that I do. It's about other things, you know, it's informed by much other practices and other types of architecture.
Okay. Zaha, I wanted to ask you something similar. I mean, training at the AA in the kind of almost the fag end of the post-war welfare era of consensus politics and so forth, how did you look back on this legacy of architecture you broadly call brutalism?
I think that there is a connection, to go back to the previous question, between Bacon and architecture. One, in the texture, which is the corduroy texturing, which is similar to the whole chiseling and concrete work in brutalism. There's another connection, which is distortion and morphing, which relates maybe more to contemporary discourses. And I think that's a very interesting observation. I mean, I'm sure it's been talked about a lot. If you look at the show, there are some images of almost cubist figures or faces. One can say almost a constructivist, distorted. They were not so distorted, they were just broken. And then the whole morphing and distortion in the figure of the faces as if they are in perpetual kind of motion. It's like almost a cinema and, And I think that does relate to contemporary discourses in architecture. I think that, first of all, the brutalist period, I mean, people started using concrete at the turn of the last century, in the 20th century. And then, you know, of course, in Corbe's work, in a Baton Rouge, where he named it, in Marseille, I think it was also an ideology that there's no also duplication, and that there is a level of toughness in the way one does work in the city. And I'm mostly also working, like in case of Louis Kahn and the, you know, in Brazil, and weather which allows them to build in concrete and vice. It was also a new material in the way it was used, not for infrastructure, but for architecture and how one can manipulate it. So I think it was fascinating to achieve some of these kind of sculptural aspects and the brise solaire and all these things which were in one material and was anti-decoration. I mean, I think it had also a puritanical, I think, aspect to it. I mean, I think it is particularly interesting that why brutalism was adopted here in such a big way. You know, there are very few early modernist work. There's quite a lot of that period of what calls it brutalism. And I think it's very stunning work. So I don't really think that brutalism is kind of ugly, but I think it's really quite stunning because in architecture, it's not only about how you deal with the building, but it's the way you interpret the program of the building. And I think there was a lot of effort made and how you interpret the diagram and a whole, and also the organizational pattern, whether it may work or not in the South Bank. I think that whole ensemble, so possible to make a whole ensemble of a similar period or same period of work, which was in the 20th century, was very critical. Now, of course, there were aspects of modernity which did not maybe always work, like the idea of kind of freeing the ground and lifting everything into another plane and the bridges. But I think the desire to beautify them, I think, is wrong, because their strength is in the power of that gesture. And maybe, and then it goes back, it connects then to painting. And I think if architects could use the same technique as painting, which is layering, you know, you paint one layer, and if it doesn't work, you put another layer, you know, and I think that's what was really exciting about the Bacon work, is that it is textures through also many layers and using different material. If architecture could use layering in the way, not in the layering of the skin, but the layering of the idea, and therefore you can add layers to maybe an existing building and remedy what is not seen as perfect about it. So I think there is a connect between painting and some sort of, not painterly technique, but the idea of layering, I think, is a very important component in the way you can work in the city and the way you can work on large, complex projects. You cannot have a single idea for a large project. You have to have many ideas. And I think that does connect to a kind of, you know, art technique, and not as opposed to like in the 20th century where it was a kind of all through reduction technique where you reduce it to kind of have it the most puritanical form, but also then you return back to it and layer it with other information. So there is that connection, which I think conceptually is, for me, more interesting than the physical kind of comparison between one an artist and that period.
Thank you. Of course, Bacon will never have the indignity of somebody coming along and smoothing over the surfaces 40 years later.
Well, I mean, they do that with kind of when they do repair to painting. I mean, they do, you know, it's known that they are destroyed some of the time because, like the Russian work, which is quite rough, and when they do repair, they smooth it out, you know, out, and smoothen it out, which is not what was never the intention. The intention was never about painting it perfectly. The intention was if we could get the composition correct and to show what it's like to do these, you know, things.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being a patient audience. Your time is about to come when you can address questions. One of the things that surprised me about the panel is that beforehand I was concerned that if you get a panel of architects and theorists and teachers on with the excuse of being related to a painting exhibition, whether they could actually make any kind of connection at all, or whether the discussion would be a purely architectural one, which would have been fine. I've been surprised that all of our panelists have made very, very coherent and absolutely direct relationships between the two cultures. And I think it says something about Bacon as well, the power of Bacon, that he's kind of hung over this discussion in a much more kind of unequivocal way than I imagined he might. So can I invite questions from the audience, please? Rowan. Sorry.
You can come here.
And a microphone is charging towards you as we speak. Perhaps you could say who you are.
I'm Rowan Moore, architecture critic of the Evening Standard. Something that's striking about the architecture of this period, which is generally absent from architecture now, is the way it gets in the way and the way it wants to get in the way, for which is one of the reasons why it's often disliked and one of the reasons why it sometimes fails, but it's also something that is interesting about it, that architects of the Brutalist period wanted to make people see things differently, behave differently, redirect them, challenge their preconceptions about the way the world was. And I think that is something that architecture of this period had in common with art in general. And I think there was this idea throughout most of modernism that there was a relationship between painting and architecture in a way that I think has disappeared now. So there's this idea that you could move, an architect could be as annoying, if you like, or as challenging as a painter and possibly had to be. So I suppose the question is, assuming anybody on the panel agrees with this, is should architecture now rediscover some of that spirit of getting in the way, or has the world just changed?
Patrick, did your architecture get in the way, and should modern should contemporary architecture get in the way now?
I think it's a very good question, actually. One side of me feels that it should definitely not get in the way, that it should be a far more friendly thing than it is. And I'm not now trying to differentiate between beautiful and ugly, but just something that feels warm and that you want to be in or live with. That seems to me to be a very key point. And while I can be amazed by certain buildings that go up, only a few of them, I think, I find that they're strange in terms of what I'm talking about, or what I'm thinking about at any rate, in terms of something feeling friendly. I don't think I can add to that.
Tony, do you think contemporary architecture needs to rediscover some of that aggressiveness, that in-your-faceness?
I wouldn't put it that way, but I think we're in a moment of a peculiar lack of resistance to events. And it's very interesting that I can't name the person, but a member of the Clinton cabinet has, I think, just written saying that the Clinton regime was far too, it didn't recognize that although it favored the expansion of capitalism as a way of producing a tax base and producing welfare, it didn't understand that government, in such an expansion of the power of commerce into everybody's life, it didn't understand that government was needed, responsible government was needed. And I think that's been a very persistent characteristic of the last 15 years, which has been a belief in that market forces will make things happen. But that's really just a crude version of let's say, an inability to understand that ideas and good intentions, I mean very, very good intentions implemented properly, do produce benefits. So in a much more a gentler way, I would say yes, because architecture, good architecture is always valuable. Good anything is always valuable, and never more so than now, I think.
It's worth remembering that in this period, the LCC, I think, was the largest architectural practice probably in the Western world, and the largest single branch of the Communist Party in Britain at the time. Okay. Another question. Somebody must be intrigued or infuriated at least by... We have a question here. If you could just wait for the microphone. Thank you.
Hello. I want to try and resist Mark Cousins' implication that... maybe I've got you wrong on this, but so you can correct me, that brutalist architecture destroyed expression in the way that Bacon's paintings did. So if you were to say the presence of a wound or meat on the canvas in place of a body took away, let's say, human expression, is that not what you were saying?
It's like the starting point of a description.
Okay.
But it's the, you know, the end of it is not sort of where you get to. I mean, let me be very clear. I'm certainly not saying anything like brutalism was ugly. Far from it. And but nor am I quite saying what you say. What I say is that maybe there are grounds for thinking of some of the achievements of brutalism in something of the same way that we might in Bacon, where when we talk about the collapse of the space of representation occasioned by, say, the appearance of the wound on a face, nonetheless, my point is, in a sense, the opposite. What Bacon achieves is actually to reintegrate it, to be able, in the materiality of, let's call it, meat, in the kind of textual dimension of meat, to bring it back in to a kind of zone of whatever you want to call it, culture, or a zone of representation. So, as it were, I think it you know, kind of relates at a more kind of simple level to what we call work of really any medium if we say it's difficult. That is to say, it's easy to resist it, but in working through it, something kind of valuable at a cultural level is produced. And we could say, you know, at one level, that's actually what culture is. The working through that difficulty, which brings an object into itself in culture as culture.
Thus, yeah, much clearer. So we should resist any simple comparison between rawness of a wound and rawness of the concrete. It's just about its difficulty.
No, it's the
brutalist architecture poses a challenge in comparison with previous ways of approaching architecture, just and Bacon's painting poses a challenge, but in a different way.
What I'm trying to say is, in a sense, in parallel with the idea of the difficult, what many people will experience and dismiss, therefore, because it's ugly, in their terms, is what Freud would call a defense. Actually, you know, the point about a defense is how to lift it, because on the other side of that defense, there is something kind of valuable to be had. And so it is, you know, bringing the meat kind of into whatever you want to call it, domain of representation, whatever, that is the possibility. And therefore, it will be true for all the fine arts, and it will be true for architecture, that anyone who works, as it were, at the edge of what is done or what is thought to be acceptable or what is thought to be normal, will always run the risk of being dismissed as being ugly. I think there's one other thing I would say is that one of the problems in trying to kind of think out the way in which the ugly opens up something extremely valuable is really two things. One, we tend to, from existence, that there really, to my knowledge, there's actually only one systematic book written on the ugly by someone called Rosencrantz in about 1857. It is very strange. And it's because everyone assumes that the whole answer is already given. What is ugly? It's the opposite of beauty. And that has completely devastated the possibility of thinking about this more interestingly. The second thing is that, you know, when people say, I was taught very young that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, it's not that statement by Hume is not so much meant as a statement of what you might call relativity. It's a statement that aesthetics is based on subjective experience. That is, that's what aesthetics is in a kind of contemporary modern, within modernity. It's subjective, which is not the same as saying it's personal. Part of the corruption of the culture is that we think the personal and the subjective are the same thing. Are the same thing.
I think the idea of difficult is something that we can usefully hang on to in this. Can I take another question, please? We have a question down here. If you can just wait for the microphone. Sorry, I'll just take this question in the front row first.
Martin Harrison, I suppose I'm here as a Baconist. The panel are much more interesting than if I'd been involved with this debate, which I suppose I just might have been at some stage. But I would like, if I first may, I have a question, but I'd like to make an observation, which I hope may be of interest. It's been so stimulating, but there are a couple of specific points, and I'm just minded to respond to them. I like Zaha's description of extreme conditions as opposed to ugly, but her remark about rawness, I've always had floating in my head, I suppose, a very literal analogy between shuttered concrete and one of Bacon's paintings in particular in this exhibition, Head 2 of 1949, which is so thickly textured that the Tate's X-ray machine wouldn't penetrate it. And he said he wanted to paint like Velázquez, meaning the fluidity, but with the texture of a hippopotamus skin. And in a very literal way, I see that hippopotamus skin painting is shuttered concrete in my head. But Zaha also mentioned rawness, and she said it in a way that I'd never considered. The corduroy that Bacon pressed onto the surface of his wet paint is a slightly later thing than the period of brutalism, but that was a fascinating analogy, I thought, again, with shuttered concrete. But also the rawness, in a way, in the period of new brutalism, art historians, art experts, whatever, describe unpainted canvas, and you see a lot of it in the exhibition here, as raw canvas. I mean, the same word is used. And that rawness was a really daring thing to do, and it's the same sort of daring, if you want to use that adjective, as in a way the new brutalists were. But my literal historical take on all of this, that's my kind of comment, but there were actually, to use the word again, concrete connections in a sense, in that if we regard new brutalism arising from debates in the architectural press, the architectural schools, and very much centered around the ICA, Bacon's close to connection, particularly to leading figures in the ICA and the independent group, such as Eduardo Paolozzi and Nigel Henderson, And therefore, if only by extension, in Rainer Banham's trying to define what this meant. I mean, Banham didn't use Bacon's paintings, but and he used Dubuffet and Jackson Pollock, people like that. But you might argue he might have used Bacon, he just didn't happen to in the Archie or wherever. Very much on the theme of the word texture, which is a keynote word up there. And Bacon, of course, his first ever retrospective, strictly speaking, was at the ICA itself in 1955, so he was a presence. And I think as a thinker, insofar as he was, and a great articulator, and in schools like the Royal College and the Slade, disseminating his ideas in his strange way in the early 1950s, there probably were verifiable connections, and they perhaps are, again, to use the pun word, concrete. But I've been really fascinated listening to what you've all said, but I mean, you're all too young to have been brutalists in the 50s, obviously, and you're speaking about, as it were, your teachers and a generation before that. But the only specific building, and here's my question finally, and my only specific question is, you've mentioned the South Bank, but are there any other buildings that one would define? No one's mentioned the Smithsons, for example, or perhaps in even the early Stirling and Gowan work or whatever. Are there any specific buildings that you yourselves would pinpoint as being British, at least, brutalism that we might, those of us trying to connect the two things, might look at or point to? Would they be early things, LCC, well, Sandy Wilson, whatever? Shut up.
There are quite a lot. I mean, of course, the Smithsons is a very important. Anna Goldfinger, all these, you know, all that. I just mentioned the South Bank, because it was apart from the housing estates, which are done a bit earlier than that period, was the only ensemble of a building which one can read as a kind of whole section of the city. I think there's another very important component to, when it says brutalism, it's so coincided that period that many of what I call buildings which are about nation building, parliaments and capitals were built in that period. From Brasilia to kind of Chandigarh, the whole Bangladesh. So and there's another issue, which is, I think we talk about brutalism and as if it's only a kind of an exterior condition, but actually the connection between it and nation building, I think, is also very important, not necessarily in here, but here in the South Bank, and it's about, representing a cultural facility, about idea of housing, which are in the Robin Hood Lane, how it connects to kind of to the UK. So there are kind of cross connections about a new way of living. I mean, Brazil, you see it a lot, but also about how the state should represent itself through a new medium, and I think that's a very interesting and exciting idea in terms of also space organization. I mean, it's amazing that all these countries invested, and I think the period was very interesting because, it was post-war invention of a new way of life after the wars here, but also adopted by other countries in Africa and the Middle East, but particularly in India and Bangladesh and Brazil and places like that, to represent the state through that medium. And I think it's, of course, many of them influenced by Kobu and Louis Kahn. And I think the concrete issue returned, maybe through Tadao Ando, who was very influenced by, Louis Kahn. But the technique changed. So I think that the technique changing allowed it. It lost its roughness. It was quite smooth. It's smoothened, and therefore I think maybe people accepted it more. But I'm intrigued by the connection between that period and nation building. The state.
That's a question I'd actually like to put to the other panels to briefly nominate a particular work of brutalism they think is important. Of course, I would like to nominate the building I work in, the Royal College of Art, one of the great buildings of its period, and of course, with a beautiful Bacon hanging in it, donated by the artist. Oh, whoops, we just sold it. What a shame.
Can I mean...
And they're trying to wreck the building.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one way, in a sense, of posing the question about Bacon and architecture is in a sense, it's just a vignette, but it would repay some thought, really, is to reconsider the Bacon exhibition which was held at the Hayward. I guess, I may be wrong, but it was probably curated by David Sylvester, is that right? Now, I mean, after all, I think the building is fantastic, but somehow not everything gets shown to its best. It is quite a kind of difficult space. And some things just look fantastic there, and the Bacon did. And my memory is that that had something to do with the fact that the paintings were hung unusually kind of low on the wall. I mean, they were hung much lower so that your point of view, I mean, it was like a small act, but it had really enormous consequences for the experience of the exhibition. And somehow the kind of fit between the building, I seem to remember the exhibition wasn't that large, and it was, I think, largely figural. But it really was an astonishing and successful relation between the painting and the building.
Time presses on, but I think we've got time for at least one more question. And sorry, we have a question here.
I'm from Shanghai, China. I'm really interested in this topic, the relation between art and architecture. In terms of art and painting and architecture, I think there are quite a different way between Western and East. Say, in China, traditional China, normally, particularly in the Chinese garden, the owner of the garden normally is the artist, also is a scholar. They normally combine the artist, art and building and the garden. I'm really interested in the idea of Zaha's idea, layer like painting, architects normally layer the idea to deal the problem, and like the artist. My question is, normally in Chinese traditional painting, they are painting never ever repeated. They just do and painting at one time. What's the relation between modern architecture and traditional Chinese painting? I'm just curious about it.
About Chinese painting. I mean, I went to China in 81, and I visited all these fantastic gardens in Suzhou and in Shanghai, and at the time, I was anti-nature. I did not like nature. I just like was freaked out by every shrub I saw. But I tell you, that trip to China is a seminal trip for me. Because first, in the way these Chinese guys were organized, and the other thing which I think was very exciting is the whole use of rock and the idea that they schlepped these rocks across China to take them to salt lakes, and the idea of erosion. And I think that one can use these techniques not literally, but in a way to how to design a project. I mean, it's not literally I would use the rock and how it eroded, because they became very, they're quite distorted and organic. But what was interesting is that the idea of erosion, that you can use a solid mass and you can erode it to allow certain kind of light to penetrate. So it's more conceptual. And I was also intrigued by the accurateness of some of the Chinese scrolls, because I always thought they were fantasies till I went to China, that, you know, the mist does hover over the lakes, and there are the willow trees, which are exactly like these drawings. So it was kind of not totally total realism, but it was pseudo realism. I think it's more to do with the idea. And I think that I was supposed the same with art, that you have to kind of have a concept and you have to... But I think with architecture, it is really very important that these things come together. I think what is appealing to me about the whole use of concrete in building is because we don't have to duplicate the structure to the exterior. So I occupy structure, in a sense. We occupy structure. And that was what was really the shift originally in one's own kind of research from like the planes like in the modernist period, to much more volumes and much more complexity. And I think that in the brutalist period, let's say, there was an aspect about how to represent or discover space within these volumes, because it was like the National Theatre, Lasden, it was all about strata. And I think there is a connection to that, and some aspect of quarrying and landscape, and I think void and carving out spaces within this building, which I think what made them these kind of really tough, large buildings. I mean, in Brazil, there's some extraordinary stuff done in São Paulo or Rio, and it's amazing. And of course, a lot of the Chilean architects who worked with Corbu when I went to Chile also did incredible concrete work. And, I think there are many great examples, but they relate back to this idea of a new world, you know. And I think this fed back here, the idea of the new world, you know, not relating to a colonial past and representing a new era. I think it was a very exciting moment, I think, I noticed it when I was in Iraq in the 60s, before I even came to school here. That was a very important and a tremendous impact on me and my generation.
Thank you. We won't put this to the test, but I think if you tried any question about the relationship between art and architecture and Zaha, she would immediately come back with a coherent answer and bring it back to brutalism as well. In a second, we are running out of time, but we started late, so I hope we're allowed one final question. I would like to prepare the panelists for that nasty thing that chairs do, which is to ask them to make a single concluding thought, each of them, before we finish. But while they think about that in panic, perhaps I could invite a last question. And we have one at the...
Hi. It's funny, we talked a lot about the South Bank and the Hayward Gallery, and it strikes me that one of the things that characterises those spaces around the South Bank is the walkways as sort of arenas for public performance, almost stages or a theatre. And of course, one of the most characteristic features of Bacon are these sort of stages and frames on which something seems to be enacted. And I just wondered if that's perhaps a useful comparison for bringing Bacon and brutalism together. Is this perhaps an idea of drama or performance?
Well, we have an architect of art galleries and dramatic spaces here, so...
Patrick will answer that. I haven't got an answer to this, sorry.
Would anyone like to respond to that?
Yeah, I can.
Zaha will.
Well, I mean, I think that really relates more to this idea that, you know, the new ground in modernity should be left open, and that there's another terrain or strata which operates above that domain, which becomes the tissue which connects everything. I think it's that really was a kind of very large ideology of the modernist period and in that period as well. I mean, if you look at the Barbican, it has similar thing with, you know, elevated streets. So the idea of the elevated street it could be seen as that, or in the Unité as kind of internal corridor, the same with the Smithsons building with their entire lives. So this idea of actually extending the public domain, the civic domain, to not only the ground but to other levels is also a very important kind of idea of that period. I'm not sure how it relates back to Bacon. Just very tragic that they cut off these arteries in the South Bank, left them dangling there, going nowhere.
Absolutely. And elsewhere in London as well.
Yeah, I know.
So, if in turn, could I ask the panellists for a brief concluding thought, Mark?
Mark is bored.
Could I actually just respond to the question? I mean, as my... I thought that the question was really very interesting. It occurred to me, as it were, that no one's ever really kind of written a history in the 20th century of what you might call the platform. And it's as if somehow the idea of a platform is a rather kind of unacknowledged, but oddly crucial space. It's as if many traditional kind of objects in the 19th century kind of decompose and are reconfigurated, and somehow the space for that reconfiguration is sort of the platform. But it's also perhaps at a more kind of, also at a painterly level. And in a sense, you know, Bacon is a sort of constructs these kinds of platforms, which I think it's very difficult to kind of quite think about. And you keep sort of bumping into this word, you know, to express a whole range of phenomena. So I think, you know, I would resist thinking of it as a stage, although it might be a space for performance. But I don't think it's a stage in a kind of traditional sense. But it is something about something that we've never quite acknowledged within a kind of spatial regime.
I mean, event. I think these were, you know, invented for kind of event to take space in rather an informal way, because these spaces were not are not linear, or they're not done in kind of, they are asymmetrical. They have don't have, you know, they are slightly randomized, and so it allows for a chance event. And there's a lot of that, you know, from the...
I'll wait for the PhD application on the unwritten history of the platform in 20th century architecture. Patrick, a last thought from you. And perhaps you might bear in mind the earlier question about thinking about a particular work of British brutalism that this audience should think about and go and see.
Well, I was actually thinking about something slightly different, but I still think it's worth saying that when Francis Bacon was in his 20s, let's say in the 1930s, before he started seriously painting, he was concerned with design and very much a follower of Le Corbusier. Now, it's not my purpose to run down Le Corbusier, but I think that his big problem for all of us was that he thought only internationally. He had no idea of the boundaries of countries and the thought that went on within those countries. The world was just going to be the same all over. And I do think that as architects, who followed Le Corbusier, we've made a mistake in that direction, because I think our architecture could be much richer to be, as it were, more British as opposed to any other country. And I think that's a thought very definitely worth thinking about. Thank you.
A final thought, and possibly a building? We haven't had a building asked for you.
Well, I just to pick up on Patrick's point, and a few other points that have been made here, I mean, brutalism, the building that you identify as brutalist, which is the Royal College of Art, seems to me to have another status. And I think what interests me is the way that Corbusier's architectural language, which he developed in the Unité, which is where Béton Brut originated or was brought into architecture, and which became part of almost everybody's vocabulary. And that was the vocabulary, for example, of nation building, which Zaha mentions. But what's interesting is that the Royal College of Art, in fact, I think comes from a slightly different moment when Le Corbusier was a deep participant in SIAM, which was a collaborative effort to expand the early vocabulary of modernism into a tenable language for everyday events, but also to one that could deal with that locality, which is what Patrick complains that it didn't. But in fact, it did, and the Royal College of Art is an example of that. If you look at the building, it's hugely, in my view, hugely influenced by a Victorian building, and that's what's so interesting about it because of its context. And so it's sort of imbibed upon of the culture of Britain and matched that with a Corbusian ethos. But I'm going to, as a concluding remark, I would say that the interest for me in Bacon is not, well, the interest for me in Bacon is something that he said, which I, you know, I've read a lot about Bacon and been impressed by him for a long period of time. What I think I found most interesting was that he spoke of his painting technique as a means of circumventing his rationality and finding a way whereby he could, I can't remember his exact words, but I think it was to somehow explore his nervous system and its reactions. And for me, that's a very interesting position because it's one which you could say comes from surrealism, but it's one that I think doesn't have the... there was some kind of doctrinaire quality of surrealism. But so to conclude, the feeling that I have about what Bacon was attempting to do is applicable to architecture, but I think in a way that's it's very different. It's very different from, it would have different characteristics from Bacon's painting, but I think it's a valid inquiry which you could use in architecture.
Thank you. So, last thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think that British brutalism is very, I think, it is very related to, it's not international. You know, I mean, they so-called use the same material, but I think that if you look at all the housing projects, whether Brunswick Center, Smithwick Center, the Alexandra Road, they all have the desire at the time to reinvent the city through a different, idea of, London is made of kind of a housing matrix, and I think it was interesting how one inserted a housing product of a different era in that domain. I don't want to delay everybody, but I had an interesting once observation, which was talking about globalism. I used to go to Hong Kong a lot, and of course, you know, if you look at the New Territories, all the buildings are made in Cartesian block. So it's Le Corbusier kind of Ville Radieuse repeated a lot of times. And it could work in Hong Kong because of the angle of the sun and they are very close to each other. On the hills, you know, near the New Territories, it's all, and even in Hong Kong Island, and central around that area. I then went again to see the Unité in Marseille, because I'm doing a tower there, and Marseille is also a slab city. You know, it's very influenced by Corbusier. They're not all a Corbusier, but it's very influenced by Corbusier. So I went to the Unité, and I went on the top, you know, where they have the swimming pool and these funny things, and I looked out, and there was a hill opposite, and it flashed that it was very similar to these buildings in Hong Kong, in that whole kind of landscape. Now, somebody might think it's really terribly boring, but I thought it was very exciting that two very distant places became connected. It's my phone. somebody telling me to shut up and get up.
No one said that.
No, but it was very exciting to make this connection through architecture, and I think that that's it.
Thank you. As a historian of architecture, it's always a wonderful reminder what good historians and how knowledgeable architects are about their own discipline and about other disciplines. I'm not sure that we've talked that much about texture tonight, which was the excuse, but we've talked about an awful lot of other things, and we've talked more about Bacon and about brutalism in the same conversation than I thought maybe was possible. And I think that's very interesting. Post-war Britain was a very extraordinary place, and its legacy, we've still never managed to make sense of it, and it's very interesting that right now there is so much retrospection about that period. The Bacon Show, the Cold War Modern Show, the excellent Cold War Modern Show at the V&A, the refurbishment of certain key buildings from that period. And I think the debate about the legacy of that period is one that will continue long into the future. In a second, I'd like you to show your appreciation for this extraordinarily erudite panel. But first, I would like to give a personal thank you, firstly, to the Architecture Foundation, and in particular to Justin, and secondly, to Tate Britain, and in particular to Victoria Walsh, for the extraordinary amount of organisation they put into this event. I hope to see many of you again for the second of these debates about the city later in the month. But before that, and before we go and restage Bacon arriving in the bar at the AA, can I ask you to thank Mark Cousins, Zaha Hadid, Tony Fretton, and Patrick Hodgkinson.
Just briefly, on behalf of Tate Britain and the Architecture Foundation, our real thanks to Joe, who also put an enormous amount of work and preparation in thinking and helping us through this. So thank you to Joe, and thank you to all for coming. I hope we will see some of you on the 22nd, but in the meantime, do come and join us for a drink outside. Thank you very much.